All right, the next matter on for oral argument this morning is Melissa Lorsung versus Commissioner of Public Safety. Each of you will have 15 minutes to present your arguments with an additional 5 minutes to later if you'd like to use that time for rebuttal. Please state your name as you commence each leg of your argument so we can keep track of it in the audio recording that we make available to the public. And the timing restrictions are indicated in the lectern. There's a light and a clock, and there's a button that allows you to raise or lower the lectern to match your height for your convenience. Council, whenever you're ready to proceed, you have the floor.
Good morning, Your Honors. Council, may it please the court. My name is Ryan Grove, and I represent the appellant, Melissa Lorsung. Melissa Lorsung is asking this court to reverse the district court's order in sustaining the revocation of her driver's license. The single issue in question before this court is whether the initial minimal suspicion of impairment was dispelled. That's something that the district court simply overlooked and did not answer. When we're looking at the district court order, it reads somewhat odd. It talks about inherently that Officer Santerre is not credible. It talks about a collision, and it talks about the admission of drinking, and ignores everything regarding the investigation and whether or not that initial minimal suspicion was dispelled. I do want to talk about this collision. It's something that the district court focused on. I'm sure it's something that respondent will focus on, and a collision has been discussed before this court many times as an objective indicator of impairment. But I'd implore this court to consider that collision the same way that the independent witnesses on scene did, and the same way that the trained and experienced officers did.
Now, the district court seemed to find that the collision occurred with your client driving into the pedestrian, but there also was some discussion of the pedestrian walking into the car. Was the district court's finding, well, address the finding that of the district court that your client drove into the pedestrian as opposed to the pedestrian walking into the car?
The district court found that it appeared more likely that the drunk pedestrian was the major contributing factor in this collision. And that's what the independent witnesses said. That is what the trained, experienced officers said. After they did their investigation, they talk amongst themselves, and they coin it, as I'd implore this court to, as a drunk pedestrian hit a sober driver. That is an important distinction when we're looking at other cases where there is a collision as an indicator of impairment. I'm not here arguing that there was no objective indicators of impairment. There were. They were investigated, but they were dispelled. And that's why this case is like Horn.
Just so I can get a big picture, there was some argument about the scope of the stuff. There's a sort of a collision that's being investigated, and then it turns into an impairment investigation. I just want to be clear. You don't dispute that given the time of day, the location, and the fact of a collision with a car and a pedestrian, that the officer had a reasonable basis to investigate the possibility of drunk driving.
I do not dispute that.
All right.
In fact, I think he did a good job in investigating that. But that's where we can focus on Horn. And I'll get to Mack then to differentiate the two. On Horn, an individual was stopped for a seatbelt violation. There was indicators of impairment and narcotic use, and the officer decides to issue and hand and deliver a citation to Horn, the driver, and ask Horn, do you have any questions? This court said that the action of giving the citation constituted a clear and definitive end. In fact, the court really concluded it couldn't think of a more clear and definitive end to the initial investigation than the issuance and the delivery of a citation. I can think of something more in a DWI case. That's here. After Officer Santerre properly investigated this, after he had the initial minimal indicia of impairment, he ran her through field sobriety tests. He affirmatively opined that she was not drunk. Then officers allowed that once initially suspected impaired driver to get back behind the motor vehicle, back and drive.
Can I change that? I'm going to offer a hypothetical. I know it's not the facts of this case. I'm just, it might help me to understand where there are points of departure. Assume an officer stops a driver leaving a parking lot of a bar 2 a.m. for an equipment violation. And in the course of the discussion, the driver says, you know, I had three beers. I'm starting to feel intoxicated, and I'm likely to be over 0.08. That's all. Reasonable suspicion?
Well, I can see where the court's going with this.
Well,
the court's focusing on what happened when Ms. Lorsung was reapproached. That is different.
I understand you want to distinguish the hypothetical, but just for the sake of our discussion, would you agree that that would be reasonable suspicion if that was the circumstance, if that's all we had?
Can you repeat it one more time?
Sure. Officer sees a person driving a car, leaving the parking lot of a bar at closing time, 2 a.m., sees an equipment violation, pulls the driver over, has a brief discussion with the driver, and in the course of the discussion, the driver says, I had three beers, I'm starting to feel intoxicated, I'm probably over 0.08, and that's all. Does the officer, based upon that, without observing anything else, have reasonable suspicion to request a preliminary breath test?
He does. And I see the difference, though. I understand the court's getting at Ms. Lorsung at the end, and that is somewhat of what she said to law enforcement. The difference between this hypothetical and the facts of this case are that Your Honor's question is one single investigation, no break in the chain, no investigation into minimal indicia of impairment, field sobriety testing, an affirmative decision and opinion based upon a learned, experienced officer that she's affirmatively not drunk, affirmatively that the collision was not due to Ms. Lorsung's impairment or alcohol use. Very different from what transpired here.
We don't focus on the officer's subjective assessment that your client wasn't drunk. We look to determine whether there's objective bases on which a reasonable officer might find reasonable suspicion of impairment. Isn't that the focus?
That is true. And that leads me to Mack, Your Honor. The commissioner relies on that same argument, saying that this argument is similar to Mack. It couldn't be further from the opposite to one another. In Mack, an officer stops a vehicle for erratic driving, swerving, crossing the fog line three times, approaches the vehicle. There is an overwhelming odor of alcohol. There is an open bottle of whiskey. There are multiple beer cans, and the officer immediately walks back to his squad and makes a reckless, flippant remark to a colleague saying, good thing no one's drunk. He didn't investigate. Here, Officer Santerre is dispatched to a collision. He's been advised and informed that alcohol was consumed by the parties. He does a good job diligently investigating this. After his investigation is when he forms the conclusion that this individual is not drunk. He testified that before I went back to offer a PBT, I had zero indicators of impairment. He gave the individual, Ms. Lorsung, after HGN, not citation actually, because he didn't believe that she was wrong in the collision. He gave her a case number and talked about insurance, that he doesn't think much will happen of this. And then another officer, Yang, who the...
He didn't actually say you're free to go, correct?
Correct. And in Horn, the officer did not tell the driver you're free to go. So this court looked at the actions, not the words. It's not the subjective belief. It's the totality of the objective factors. Issuance of a citation, issuance of a case number in this case. Sit tight 2 minutes. I might talk to the other parties, and I'll get you
again, this is all telling us what's in the officer's head subjectively, that the officer at that point doesn't believe she's impaired. But that's not really what we focus on, though, again, is it? We're looking for the objective criteria, one way or the other, that would either cause an officer to suspect or evidence of dispelling the suspicion.
The objective criteria is the initial suspicion of the vehicle was dispelled. No odor of alcohol, no bloodshot, watery eyes, no slurred speech, no balance issues. And the question is, did these officers objectively have reasonable, articulable suspicion that she could no longer possess the clear intellect because of impairment from alcohol? She's given a case number. She's advised by Officer Yang, who's a licensed, experienced peace officer, and we should remember the collective knowledge doctrine. He's talking to her the entire time. He allows her to move her vehicle. He sees no sign of impairment and says, you're free to go. Objectively, those circumstances say any initial minimal suspicion was dispelled. The PBT request at the false request of the pedestrians, the record shows the pedestrians never asked Officer Santerre to go ask for a PBT.
Would it matter?
No, it wouldn't matter. They're not allowed to ask. But the totality of circumstances here show any initial minimal suspicion was dispelled, and I'd ask the court then to reverse the district court's order sustaining the revocation. Unless there are further questions, I'll wait for rebuttal.
I have one. The officer investigates the collision to determine whether impairment was the cause. And this gets back to my initial question of whether it was the pedestrian who walked into the car or the car that drove into the pedestrian. One factor you haven't discussed is the fact of a person in a parking lot being hit by a car when the parking lot was lit enough. Apparently the person wasn't running in front of into the car, but walked into the car. What, if anything, how does that objective circumstance work into the officer's analysis or our analysis of reasonable suspicion? The driver who's not impaired would presumably be able to see and look around and make sure there's no one that is going to come in contact with the car as the driver is backing out.
Well, Your Honor, my answer would be accidents happen. We all know that. There are thousands of accidents a month, I would presume, and a lot of those have nothing to do with alcohol impairment. So,
well, right, that's true. There may be, but if there's an accident at 2 o'clock in the morning, two cars leaving the bar, the case law would suggest that is a basis for suspicion.
I still agree with that point, Your Honor.
Even though there accidents happen, as you say.
I still agree with that point. I think we're agreeing that initially Officer Santerre did the right thing, acted diligently, investigated based on a collision at 2 a.m. in a bar parking lot. There was some discussion of alcohol being used, and he did an investigation to decide, do I have a reasonable, articulable suspicion that the alcohol caused her to be impaired, which then caused the collision, and she may be under the influence? After he concluded no, 12 minutes later, the request of the PBT is no longer valid, given the circumstances of, we're not going to keep you. Here's your case information. Have a great night. So for those reasons, I'd ask the court to reverse the district court order.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You have 5 minutes of rebuttal time. Counsel for respondent.
Good morning. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Ryan Passion. I represent the Commissioner of Public Safety, the respondent in this case. The question before the court is whether three objective facts provided reasonable articulable suspicion of driving while impaired so as to request appellant provide a preliminary breath test. First, appellant was leaving a bar parking lot at approximately 2 a.m. after the bar closed. Second, appellant backed into a pedestrian. And third, appellant had been drinking and admitted to consuming three beers.
Let me pause you there. Aren't factors number one and two the same? I mean, the fact that a person's at a bar, leaving a bar at 2 a.m., and she admitted drinking, I mean, the inference you draw from someone leaving a bar is that they were drinking.
Sorry. For me, the first objective indicator was she's leaving a bar parking lot at 2 a.m. after the bar closed. The second is she backed into a pedestrian. There was an accident.
Right. And the third, you said admitted she was drinking.
Correct.
Isn't the third and the first effectively the same thing from an objective standpoint? Isn't the reason it matters that a car is leaving a bar at 2 o'clock in the morning is the reasonable suspicion that the driver has been drinking at the bar?
Well, I can see why they would compound, but I don't think that they overlap completely. Like, the Venn diagram of people who leave a bar and the people who admit drinking may be...
What's the difference? What more do you get out of the third fact that you don't get out of the first fact?
Well, people go to bars and don't drink, so the officer learned that this person admitted to drinking. That's additional information that the officer had when he showed up to the scene.
What additional inculpatory information does the officer get beyond the fact that the driver is drinking, from the fact that she's leaving the bar at 2 in the morning?
Okay, I can agree with the court that once someone has admitted to drinking, the fact that they were leaving a bar parking lot is probably not as relevant as the fact that they just admitted they were
drinking. That's the reason why it's relevant, right?
Okay. Correct, yes,
so,
I'm sorry.
So backed into a pedestrian and she was drinking. So backed into a pedestrian, I thought that the officers had concluded that the evidence had shown the officers and that the district court, at least at one point, accepted and then seemed to switch to a different perspective, that the collision between the car and the pedestrian was the result of the pedestrian, quite impaired, walking into the car. Is that correct or not correct?
I don't believe that is a complete assessment of how the district court analyzed this. I think the district court said the pedestrian was substantially at fault, but the district court also said that that was one, part of the totality of the circumstances the district court relied upon. Officer Santerre testified on page 31 that in his experience, someone who wasn't impaired would be able to look around and see people in the parking lot, and in his experience, those sorts of accidents would not, maybe perhaps not exist.
And that makes sense to me. And that would cause, I think, a reasonable officer to say, let's investigate for impairment. Let's talk to the driver and find out more. So in this case, correct me if I'm wrong, that's what happens. The officer engages with the driver, sees no bloodshot eyes, no watery eyes, no slurred speech, no imbalance, physical imbalance when she's standing. Does perform the horizontal gaze nystagmus test and sees no nystagmus at any point. There's some argument that the district court didn't accept, which is that she failed to reach the point of maximum deviation at each end. But so at least we have a score so far of zero. The officer says no nystagmus. So the officer does investigate impairment, believes there's no impairment. It seems the officer's conclusion was reasonable from the officer's perspective that there was no impairment. And I guess what troubles me a bit in this case is that it seems like what the officer was doing at the time of the insistence of the PBT was that the officer wasn't, correct me if I'm wrong, the officer wasn't basing the request for a PBT on the officer's reasonable suspicion that the driver was impaired, but in the officer's desire to confirm the officer's belief that the driver was not impaired. Have I correctly summarized the mindset of the officer going into the PBT?
Well, I think the officer testified that his suspicion had not been dispelled. He expressly said, I still harbored some belief that this person could be impaired by alcohol. And so he did testify to that in the court.
Well, he harbored some belief that she may be impaired, but we're talking about reasonable suspicion.
Right.
It seemed to me, based upon the officer's statements at the scene to other officers and to the driver, that the officer wanted to confirm his belief and his fellow officer's belief that the driver was not impaired, and to satisfy any concern by those around, the pedestrians, since there had been a collision, that he had done everything he needed to do to confirm that she wasn't impaired. Am I misunderstanding the record, or have I accurately described the record?
So I can agree with the court that the statements that he made to the appellant were, I want to do this so that those people can't say I'm not doing my job. I want to do this to make sure you're okay to leave. But the action of approaching and requesting a preliminary breath test show that this officer was not confident this person was sober.
Why wouldn't it show what the officer said? Which was that, I believe you're not impaired, and I'm doing this for everybody else's sake, to confirm my belief that you're not impaired.
Well, I think the court would run into a difficult scenario if it was required to parse the degree to which the officer believed there was a potential impairment versus the degree to which he wanted to confirm non-impairment versus the degree to which he was motivated.
Okay, what was the reasonable basis? What were the circumstances that would lead him to believe that she was impaired at the time that he asked for the breath test? Just the ones you mentioned, that she said she was drinking, and the collision.
Well, those are the two main objective indicators of impairment. This court has said you only need one.
You say you only need one. If she just said I was drinking, that wouldn't be enough.
Well, if the officer
there's nothing more.
If the officer knew she was behind the wheel of a vehicle and she admitted to drinking, that may be enough.
That would be enough if an officer stops someone and he's asked the question, hey, were you drinking? And the driver says yes. That gives the officer reasonable suspicion without anything more to suspect impaired driving?
It's a totality of the circumstances analysis.
Right, those are the totality that you just mentioned. That one factor is enough. Is that factor enough? No indicia. So you've got an officer stops a car, no bloodshot eyes, no watery eyes, no slurred speech. Yes, officer, I had something. I had some drinks at the bar. Officer does horizontal gaze, nystagmus, no nystagmus. The fact that the individual was drinking, in your view, would be the one factor that would be enough, reasonable suspicion.
I think this court has said that an odor of alcohol alone would potentially be enough for reasonable articulable suspicion. It's said that multiple times, most recently in Jensen v. Commissioner.
But in this case, there was no initial odor of alcohol. So
right.
Going back to Judge Ross's question, no odor of alcohol. The driver said she was drinking. No indicia of impairment. She passes horizontal gaze nystagmus. Is that enough for reasonable suspicion?
If the court is comfortable saying that one objective indicator of intoxication, such as the odor of alcohol, is enough, I don't see why an admission to drinking would be substantially different than the odor of alcohol.
Cite the case.
Can't the admission of drinking be drinking that occurred hours ago? I mean, an odor of alcohol suggests there was recent drinking.
Of course, and that's why I say it's a totality of the circumstances analysis. If the officer believes this person said, I drank at the bar that I just left, that's obviously different than I drank this morning at 3 a.m. or at some reasonable hour to be drinking in the morning. I don't know what that would be. But.
So your position is that there's precedent that establishes that if an officer knows, based upon the odor of alcohol or a person's statement, that that individual had been drinking after a horizontal gaze nystagmus test comes up zero, no bloodshot eyes, no watery eyes, nothing else, no driving conduct that would suggest impairment. That you're saying there's a case out there that says that's enough for reasonable suspicion? Which case would that be?
I'm not saying that there's a case that says exactly that. I'm saying this court has said in Jensen v. Commissioner of Public Safety from this year, one, the odor of alcohol alone may be enough to expand a traffic stop to request a preliminary breath test. I would also note that in State v. Creviston, LaRude, spelled C-R-E-V-I-S-T-O-N hyphen L-E-R-U-D, the court again opined that an odor of alcohol alone is a single objective indicator of alcohol that might justify expanding a traffic stop.
Expanding a traffic stop to investigate drunk driving is different from reasonable suspicion to believe the person is impaired so that you can ask for a PBT. So I'm wondering if there's a case that supports that.
I'm sorry, I think the reasonable articulable suspicion standard applies to both of those things.
Oh, so an officer who stops a car and has reason to believe the person is has consumed alcohol, just so I understand, that's all you need. You don't need any driving conduct that indicates impairment, slurred speech, watery eyes, nothing else, just the odor of alcohol or the statement that alcohol was recently consumed. The PBT can result from that. That's reasonable suspicion to believe impairment.
Well, and I believe that's what opposing counsel has agreed, that the factors when the officer in this case performed the horizontal gaze nystagmus test, those factors justified doing field sobriety tests. So the factors known to the officer at the time that he requested.
Sure that concession was made, but I'll let counsel speak for himself on that one.
Well, I didn't hear a protestation about the horizontal gaze nystagmus test. That's a field sobriety test that I believe has been agreed to, that performing that test was an appropriate method of investigation. I believe opposing counsel said that at the beginning of the argument.
I thought what opposing counsel acknowledged was that based upon the circumstances of the driving conduct, leaving a bar at that hour and the fact that there had been a collision is enough to expand the scope of an accident investigation into an impaired driving investigation. But the horizontal gaze nystagmus test doesn't matter in this case, does it, since there was no inculpatory evidence that resulted from it? Nothing from the horizontal gaze nystagmus test adds to reasonable suspicion in this case.
Correct, yes. My argument is that under this court's precedential decision in Mezenberg v. Commissioner of Public Safety, the same reasonable suspicion that justified doing the horizontal gaze nystagmus test also justified requesting a preliminary breath test, because the horizontal gaze nystagmus test didn't break the reasonable articulable suspicion that's required to investigate this driver for DWI after learning the circumstances that an accident occurred in a bar parking lot at 2 a.m. and that.
I've gotten a bit far afield of, and it's my fault, I've taken afield from appellant's actual argument, which is that the officer did investigate and found evidence that would objectively dispel any suspicion of impairment. Would you address that argument?
Yes, Your Honor. The case that I believe is most on point would be Mezenberg, the Commissioner of Public Safety from 2021, where this court rejected the argument that intervening field sobriety testing somehow dispelled the suspicion of impairment that existed at the time the stop was the inception of the stop. This court reached the exact same conclusion in State v. Krinke, K-R-I-N-K-E, cited in my brief, where Krinke argued that his subsequent interaction with the officer dispelled reasonable articulable suspicion because the driver in that case passed multiple field sobriety tests. And the court said, no, the suspicion that justified requesting those field sobriety tests still justified a preliminary breath test. So the reasonable articulable suspicion that existed to justify field sobriety testing in this case, i.e. the HGN, also existed to justify the preliminary breath test, and passing a field sobriety test does not break the chain of reasonable suspicion that justified the first test.
So in Messenburg, you had slurred speech by the driver, eyes were watery, glassy, and bloodshot.
Correct.
How is that this case?
I'm not citing Messenburg for the facts as much as...
No, you're saying, I mean, you're right. If field sobriety tests, if you perform perhaps sufficiently on them, doesn't dispel suspicion when you actually have other bases for suspicion. Bloodshot, watery eyes, slurred speech, all the usual indicia of intoxication. I don't think this case supports your argument.
Well, I'm sorry, I see my time is up.
No, you can answer the question, and I know Judge Cochran has questions as well.
Yeah, so I think if we start at a baseline of there was reasonable articulable suspicion to request the horizontal gaze nystagmus test in this case, which I don't see appellant disputing, and the district court concluded was correct, that reasonable suspicion, the argument is that that reasonable suspicion was dispelled. So if that reasonable suspicion existed in the first place, something intervening, the horizontal gaze nystagmus test performance, is the only thing that happened between that reasonable suspicion and the preliminary breath test in this case. And Messenburg says that the performance on that field sobriety test does not necessarily dispel an officer's suspicion. And so does State v. Krinke, and there are other cases cited in my brief, such as State v. Murphy.
Judge Cochran.
Is this case distinguishable from the Horn case? I recognize that Horn is a non-precedential case, but appellant suggests that we should look at that for persuasive value in terms of the argument about the reasonable suspicion being dispelled.
Yes, Your Honor, it's distinguishable on the facts, most obviously, because the officer who was doing the investigation in this case never told the petitioner that she was free to leave, didn't actually conclude his investigation until he reapproached with the preliminary breath test and said, before you leave, I just want to make sure that you're okay to drive. So that's the easiest way of distinguishing.
Well, but he did say something to the effect of, we'll get you out of here in a couple minutes, right?
Correct. Indicating that stick around until I talk to you again, we'll get you out of here, doesn't mean you should leave. It doesn't mean you're free to leave. So I think there are the facts of this case distinguish Horn. I think, pointed out in my brief that Horn doesn't seem to have decided the objective basis as much as the officer's subjective belief that it looked to the officer's subjective belief in releasing the person from the scene rather than the totality of the objective circumstances. But that's not what I would have the court distinguish Horn on. I'd have the court look to the facts of Horn and the fact that here a secondary officer never told petitioner she was free to leave. The primary officer never said that. Officer Santerre actually said, actually stopped petitioner from driving her car when she attempted or asked if she should pull it into the parking space. He said no. So I think the primary officer in this case never wanted her to leave, never wanted her to drive, and I think that distinguishes Horn.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Counsel for appellant, any rebuttal?
Thank you. And for the record, my name is Ryan Grove, and I represent the appellant.
Thank you.
The last question there was there something intervening that stopped the initial minimal suspicion of impairment? And the respondent's argument was only the HGN. Well, that's not correct. We have the fact that this driver was given case number information, which is where it becomes just like Horn. We have the fact that another officer on scene told the individual, get behind the wheel, you can drive. That's another intervening factor stopping any initial minimal suspicion of impairment. I think we have more agreement in this.
Those circumstances only tell us what was in the officer's head. They are not objective criteria on which we would determine whether a reasonable officer would reasonably suspect impairment.
Well, it was objective in Horn, and it was objective in Hickman. In Hickman, you see that the driver may not be valid. You go up there, you see they're valid. Any additional questioning is not permissible. And I want to get back to your question, Judge Ross, on the PBT and Officer Santerre. Respondent couldn't answer that. The answer is absolutely yes. The only reason Officer Santerre went up to give the PBT was to satisfy his belief that she was sober. That's not what authorizes PBTs in our state. It's contrary to statute with the PBT statute, and it certainly is not reasonable, articulable suspicion of what? Impairment. He has the opposite suspicion. I suspect that this driver, with no other individual factors, no slurred speech, no odor of alcohol, no balance issues, no concerns from any other citizens. In fact, the citizens on scene say, these guys were really drunk, the pedestrians, and walked into her as she backed out at trickle speed. When the officer 12 minutes later, after saying, here's your case information, we'll get you out of here, goes back to PBT and keep her detained or seized, that is where the problem unfolds. The ultimate question is, was this initial minimal suspicion dispelled? I think that's been answered here today. It's contrary to Mezenberg. There is a clear, definitive break. And for those reasons, I'd ask this court to reverse the district court order. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you to both counsel. Very interesting case. You'd think that after all the impaired driving cases in Minnesota that all the possible factual scenarios would have been covered in some case, but it never ceases to amaze me that something new comes up. So thank you both for your argument. Thank you for your briefing. Very helpful, and your oral argument also very helpful. Thank you for letting us take you over the time as we found the case interesting. Questioned you about it. This is our last case on our oral calendar today, so we are in recess.